From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me.
Dean Butler is my guest. He's an actor who's appeared on television, film, and Broadway, most famously on the series Little House on the Prairie. And he's written an excellent memoir, Prairie Man, My Little House Life and Beyond. Dean Butler, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you, Gary. You're very nice to have me.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah, I know. I'm delighted, always delighted to talk about Little House, about this book. But I guess in this conversation, we're really going to talk about books more than Little House, it seems to me, given what you're, and I'm looking now, the audience can't see,
yes,
but I'm looking at you seeing shelves of books behind you, hundreds of books.
I have books, CDs, movies, television.
All of it.
I have the box set of Little House on the Prairie, but I have to say I haven't really got into it yet. But, you know, one of the things I wanted to start with you is in your book, you talk about acting for stage and film and the differences between those two things. And I've always been fascinated by the difference between film acting and acting for television, especially mm-hmm. in the era in which Little House on the Prairie and so on were on the air in the network television days. I mean, I think it's different now because TVs are so big and lots of the line between television and movies isn't the way
it very was. Thin. I agree with that.
But it used to be different. And there were a lot of people who were stars on television, really good actors, David Janssen or whoever. And they never made it as movie stars. Some would go to movies and then never come back to television, James Gardner mm-hmm. being the one exception of moving back and forth. But I just wonder, do you think there's a difference between film acting and television acting?
Well, I think the distinction has been blurred by the size of the screen. I think the television screen and we're watching movies and television on 80-inch screens and we're watching it on 3-inch screens. You know, where our ability to watch things in whatever medium we have available to us has made that opportunity incredibly expansive or, you know, very tiny. I think a huge difference was the way the industry was structured. You know, I think that there was a period of time where if you made your mark in television, that's where you were going to stay. There were very few people who could cross out of that. And certainly people did. But I think that there was this distinction, and I write about it a little bit in the book, where you are a television actor or you are a film actor. Today, because of social media and because of impressions and all of that, that is so driving the audience engagement with everything. You can work anywhere if your engagement is right. And if you've got the chops to do the work, but you can work, actors go back and forth easily. Now it's still, there are still, for all the people who are trying this, and there are tens of thousands of people who aspire to this, there are probably still less than, and I'm going to insult a lot of people when I say this, but I think there are probably less than 250 people in the entire industry who matter. I mean, who really matter, who can really move the needle, who can open a movie or guarantee a tune in to television. It's a very small number of people. And I think the essence of stardom, and particularly on film and movie stardom historically, is really about a personality that pops on the screen or it doesn't. And it doesn't matter how well you read a line it matters a lot what you look like and what you sound like. I did an event years ago with a woman who was named Renee Valente, who was a very big casting director and producer. And she talked about stardom in the context of a look and a sound. And a lot of that, it's a very personal thing. It's a very personal relationship that we have with the people that we go and watch, and we find them attractive or we don't find them attractive. And it is a rare, rare gift to be able to stand in front of a camera or perform in front of a camera and occur in a way that is deeply personal and authentic, that the audience doesn't question or wonder what's going on with that performer. And I'm not a religious person, Gary, but I think it's, if I were to describe it as a God-given gift, you can teach people, where the light is, and you can teach people how to hit a mark, and you can teach people a lot of those skills. But to teach people how you teach someone to occur completely authentically in front of the camera, that's, you can't teach that. I just don't think it's possible.
You recount a conversation that your wife had with Jimmy Stewart in the book.
Yes. 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 And there was someone who could occur completely authentically in front of the camera.
And he says,
I met him one time. Yeah. I spent a little time with him one time. He was exactly the same on camera as I'd watched him be in everything that I'd ever seen him do. And I have not seen the full range of Jimmy Stewart's work. There was a lot of work to look at. Sure. I haven't seen it all. But when I met him and talked to him, I knew I was talking to the guy who I'd been watching on the screen. And when Catherine met him doing a movie called Fool's Parade, it was her first big movie, first big project, and it was his last big project where he was the star. And they were in Wheeling, West Virginia, and they were sitting on the set, and Catherine was this, beautiful, nubile 19-year-old who was just like, seeing the world in front of her. And he asks her, "What do you want to do?" And it was sort of, "Are you looking to be a star?" was the question. And Catherine's answer, and I think was very honest on her part. "No," she said, "I just want to be a working actress. I don't care about being a star." And then Jimmy Stewart, "Then you won't be a star."
Nice impression.
Then it's just,
if you don't care about it, it's not going
to
happen.
Because nobody gets to be a star who doesn't want it with every fiber of their being. Because it's too hard. It's just too hard. And you have to be just driven by it. And I think he was a guy, and he didn't give the impression that he was driven by it.
Right.
But he said it very clearly. If you don't want it, it won't happen.
I was hearing about an acting class that the actor Jeff Corey was teaching, in which he asked.
Very famous in Los Angeles acting, in Los Angeles acting circles in that period.
He asked all his students to write down a list of things they would do if they couldn't make it as an actor. And after they made the list, he said, "Well, if you wrote anything down, you can leave."
I so agree with that. I say to kids all the time, and I've talked to a lot of young collegiate actors, and I say, if there's nothing else you can see yourself doing, you have to do this. On the other hand, if there's anything else you can see yourself doing other than acting, do that, because it's just too hard. I think Jeff Corey, he really got right to it though. I mean, and he was an interesting personality as an actor.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you did study acting with some acting teachers in Los Angeles.
I mean, with Peggy Fury and with Dwayne Hickman. And I think probably most successfully with Milton Katselis, or I think I got more from Milton than from any other teacher. And he was an interesting character. Milton was, Milton was a Scientologist, and he ran his classes like a Scientology experience. He had an ethics officer in his class. And, you know, if you had a problem, if you had a problem with the way things are going, it was generally your problem, not his problem. Mm. And he was a wonderful teacher. But I think ultimately people, a lot of people soured on Milton because as brilliant a teacher as he was, and Milton believed that everyone could become a serviceable actor. You had to know your casting. You had to know where you fit in this world. You had to be able to sit in front of the television or watch a movie and know what's my part in this. And he spent a lot of time working on that with people and getting them to see what they could imagine themselves being, and then going for that. Because it's, you know, when you're a kid and you're doing this, you have this under this illusion that you can play anything.
Yeah.
As you get a little older and you're doing it, you realize, no, you're going to be doing, if you're able to do it at all, you're going to be doing very specific things, and you're going to do it again and again and again. For the most part, there are those actors who have this amazing range and they can move. Most actors working in film and television are cast in a particular way, and they are cast that way over and over and over again for as long as they are seeking to work.
Well, you talked about being we're talking with Dean Butler. He's just written this great book. It's called Prairie Man, My Little House Life and Beyond. You talk about being an actor in school, in high school. And at one point you said that you played a role and you did the best you could, considering that it was a man you were playing and it was a boy who was playing the part. That
is, right.
that there's certain physical limitations. But I'm interested in your acting classes. How were those things addressed? What exactly would happen in your acting classes?
Well, I think depends on the class, but all the classes that I was involved in dealt with a certain amount of, it was basically scene study. And where Milton was concerned, he picked the scenes because he would pull the class. And he liked to cast or work from contemporary work. There certainly was classical work done, but we weren't doing a lot of Shakespeare. We weren't doing a lot of Ibsen. We were, you know, this was a group of people who were looking to be working actors in Hollywood. It's not that they didn't work elsewhere, but that's where their work was. So he wanted people dealing with the kinds of material that they were going to address when they walked into rooms. And so there was a lot of that kind of, there was a lot of that kind of casting. And Milton's thing was, and I love this, he said, you know, all you really need for drama is a man, a woman, and a bed in a room. That's it. That's the core. And, you know, there were a lot of those scenes in class. And to play those scenes and to, you know, in a situation which is completely uncontrolled, all that, you know, that's some good training to play those scenes for young actors, and young actors really enjoy playing those scenes. So, sure, yeah. You know, it's fun stuff.
Well, that reminds me of the things, I mean, one of the things you're most famous for is kissing, because of your famous first kiss scene with Melissa Gilbert on Little House on the Prairie.
And TV Land named it the greatest kiss in TV history at one point.
It's a very little,
I don't know that that's really true. I don't know that it wants that, but that was a fun little distinction.
It's a very little chaste kiss from what I
heard. Yes, very chaste little kiss.
But you also talk about, you know, certain scenes in film and television where you get a chance to make out with a pretty woman. And I wonder if there was any kind of training that prepares you other than making out in real life. I mean, how does making out in real life?
Yeah, no, I think it's dating is what prepares you for that.
Yeah, but I mean, is there a way that you kiss in the movies that's different or in television that's different?
Well, that's interesting. I did not approach kissing differently. you know, kissing was kissing. And, you know, I delivered a kiss on the screen the way I delivered a kiss in life. That's, I mean, and look, I think that there are things to be considered in that realm. And one of the things you have to consider, which, you know, you don't necessarily think about when you're kissing on the screen, but you need to, is you need to find out what kind of lipstick the woman you're kissing is wearing and how smearable is it going to be? And, you know, is it going to stay on her? I think, but, you know, one of the things that has driven me crazy about certain actors as I watch them, and I love their work, I think these are some really talented people, but I watch certain people, I said, this guy can't kiss. he cannot kiss. And I'm going to go on a limb here and say Harrison Ford is maybe the worst on-screen kisser I've ever seen. Now, women may love kissing Harrison Ford, but I don't believe him when I watch him kissing a woman. It feels a little detached. Colin Firth is another actor. Love Actually is a wonderful, wonderful movie. And, you know, and I watch him kiss women in this movie, and I don't believe, I love him. I love his work. But as soon as it gets romantic, I'm out, because it just doesn't work for me.
When you watch Golden Age of Hollywood movies, Humphrey Bogart or Clark Gable, you assess their kissing?
Well, Clark Gable, I mean, my God, the famous kiss in Gone with the Wind. I mean, look, I can't tell you, I wasn't there. I can't tell you what that kiss was really like, but you watch that kiss on the screen, you believe that kiss. That was a hell of a kiss. That was the real deal, and I'm sure women everywhere swooned, and men watching that said, I'd like to kiss somebody that I'm in love with, that I'm passionate about like that. Because he just swept her up, and boom, done. And that was a great kiss.
One of the things that I identified with in your book, Dean Butler, you talked about how the actor, the late George Segal, had an effect on you when you saw him on screen, that he was one of the people that made you believe you could be a screen actor.
I felt that way about me. George Segal had a wonderful comedic quality, and there was he had sort of a whimsy about him that was really fun to watch. And I loved watching, as a young guy, I loved watching Robert Redford on the screen.
Oh, yeah, of course, me too.
I mean, it's like, you know, Robert Redford with that studied casual hair and the whole thing, that look, I could watch Robert Redford peel a grape. I mean, it didn't matter. There was something about him at that time in his life. Now, as he's gotten older, I feel like I'm watching more and more studied. And we haven't seen him on screen anything recently. Yes. But as he's gotten older, I feel like we're watching someone who is very practiced at what they are doing. And so it doesn't feel quite as authentic. But as a young man, he was riveting to watch on the screen for me. Oh. And for probably a lot of young guys my age, Robert Redford was the guy.
I agree. Butch Cassidy or whatever.
God. Yeah. Or The Sting, or, you know, just, yeah. All the President's Men.
Oh, he's great.
No, nothing romantic there, but I really believed him there. And I thought he and Dustin Hoffman were great together in that.
Well, just to follow up on this kissing thing.
Jeremiah Johnson. Oh, great. In Jeremiah Johnson.
Love that one. And he's not as particularly attractive in that. He's got
it. Yeah, no, but he's real. He's gritty, and he's got that pocked face. He's handsome, but he's imperfect. And I think that made him enormously appealing on the screen.
There was a movie with George Segal called No Way to Treat a Lady. And in this movie, he's teamed with Lee Remick, and they're on a boat. I think it's a ferry boat or something. And he kisses her. And he puts his hand on her face and kisses her in a very sweet way. And I was thinking, you know, if I ever get to kiss somebody, I'm going to do it just like that.
wouldn't we all love to deliver that kiss the way we watch someone on the screen? I mean, the movies and television are so important in that way for young people. we model who, look, it's not a perfect modeling, but we model our, we model behavior based on what we watch. We, these movies, these television programs, comedies, dramas, tragedies, whatever they are, we learn a lot about our own humanity watching these movies.
I can remember coming out of the movie theater, you know, when I was a kid, depending on the movie, you know, and having a certain feeling, you know, after seeing West Side Story or after seeing Hard Day's Night. You know, those were movies that gave me a certain physical feeling that I had when I came out of the theater. And I think watching movies in a theater, which is, you know, becoming a less and less thing, is really big. And, you know, watching it with the, with, you know, a thousand other people. As we used to do.
You know, and it's not a drama, but I just, I'm rewatching it again because I just love this music. You know, I'm rewatching, we went to the theater to watch Becoming Led Zeppelin.
It was fantastic, wasn't it?
And you watch these guys work on the stage. I mean, talk about sex appeal that just like explodes through the screen.
And I just don't know if watching that same film streaming it would have the effect that it had on seeing it on the big screen. I went and saw it twice because I thought it was really amazing and really good film.
Yeah, no, it's great. It's great. Now you can crank up the music, and if you have 5.1 audio in your house, you can get that music that's incredible, but it's not the same as watching their faces, you know, and that level of performance, which was just like, just dripping sex appeal as these guys were working.
But you are mainly an actor that has appeared on the small screen.
Yeah.
It was something you said in your book I thought was really interesting. You were talking about it's kind of a class thing in terms of movies are more respected because you don't pay to watch television. And thus, in those days, in the days of network TV, I thought that was really interesting. So movies are number one, or I guess theater would be number one.
Then that certainly was the number one. I think it was then. I think going back to the way people can flow back and forth.
Yeah.
I don't know that that's as big a deal today, but then definitely that was a big deal about what you paid for.
Yeah. And commercials where you started with like the lowest.
Yes.
Although I think but
you're reaching so many people with these spots.
Oh yeah, talk about that. The fact that you had a zit and the picture was in the McDonald's, every McDonald's
in Northern California. Yeah, no, and I mean, or it was like the, you know, in Coca-Cola was making hundreds of spots during those years, and you know, I got to be that guy at the end of the spot with the sun, that sun burning through the background, and you've got the Coke up and it's on a beach and it's a beautiful, we shot this at Stinson Beach at magic hour and the, you know, the beautiful people and, you know, you're with the girl and it's like, boom. And it's like, yeah, I want to drink Coca-Cola. If I could be there do that. Yeah. That was, I mean, that stuff is really fun. You're connecting to a lot of people doing commercials, but it's obviously it's not quite the same thing. But when you're starting, Gary, it's like you take every opportunity you can get to do anything that you get to do.
And that was the beginning.
That was my take. Other people maybe didn't feel that way, but I felt that way.
And that was the beginning of being recognized for you. People would say, aren't you the guy?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I did that. So I was doing a movie of the week for CBS called Forever in the Bay Area. And at that time I had a spot for Mervyn's department store, which was a big department store, not a huge department store, but a regional department store. And I was doing a spot called for a product called Dura Jeans. And this thing was running constantly. And as I was out, it wasn't that, you know, I was had just done this movie and I'm, you know, I'm feeling my oats and feeling pretty excited. It was a TV movie, but fun. A lot of kissing in that movie, by the way.
Yes.
But it was Dura Jeans. People were seeing the Dura Jeans spot. And because it had to be running multiple times an hour during a summer. It was 77. It was summer 76, summer 77, something like that. And it was everywhere. And that was very powerful. I mean, you don't realize how powerful television is until you're being seen on it all the time. And suddenly people feel like they know you.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I feel like we're best friends now because I read your book.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about politics, and you talk a little bit about politics in your book by saying, "I don't want to talk about politics, and I'm not a politician."
Yeah, I know it's a toxic subject today.
But you know, one of the things that's always been said about Hollywood, Mel Gibson and John Voight notwithstanding, is that it's very liberal. Hollywood is liberal, and everybody involved in Hollywood is liberal.
Yeah,
and you went in. At that time, I'm hoping not so much now, as a conservative or as a right wing conservative. So did you run up against resistance? Did you find people?
I think it's an excuse that people use. I don't think that people's politics, if they believe that you can deliver on the screen, they don't care what your politics are. Mm. You know, Kelsey Grammer is a pretty intense Republican. Mm. Didn't stop him on the screen. Kelsey Grammer was a funny, funny guy. Arnold Schwarzenegger was a pretty staunch Republican, still is.
Yeah.
Arnold Schwarzenegger in his period was the biggest movie star in the world, and no one cared about his politics. They cared that he could open the movie. I think that politics, I certainly have friends who absolutely believe that their careers have been cut short by their political beliefs. I just don't believe that. I don't believe that. It's something else. It's something in your work. No one is going to keep you out. I mean, look, there are people, Harvey Weinstein famously blew up women's careers when they wouldn't do what he wanted. Okay. Despicable. All of that. But that's very rare when someone will, and who has time to intentionally blow up someone's life? And who, particularly if their work is good, their work is good. And if they're showing up on time, if they're doing the publicity, if the movie's opening, if it's making money, who cares what their politics are?
I guess it's a matter of how much you know about their politics.
Well, and that's true too. And it's how, and now, Gary, we know more and more about people's politics. And I think it's become something that people are a little cautious about. You know, when I've said things, I mean, in this book, I made a comment about our president, about being in another job, being in Trump Tower in the gold leaf, you know, room at overlooking Central Park and you know, how he... We gave him he was running for office for the first time, and I handed him, we gave our host, David Faraday, who's a wonderfully talented guy. I just said, well, you know, let's run the Teddy Roosevelt Man in the Arena speech by him. He'd never heard it. He didn't know anything about it. And at the time, maybe that wasn't so shocking to me or surprising to me that he didn't know that speech or at least be aware of it. Now it doesn't surprise me at all.
Because he's not aware of anything.
That he doesn't know it. And he's just not interested in it at all. I stay a Republican today so I can vote against the insanity in primaries that I'm living with every single day, that all of us are living with every single day. I'm determined to vote against it. And as a Republican, I can vote against it in primaries. That's the only place you can really have an impact on what's going on in our political scene.
Well, you know, I don't have any problem with Republicanism, although I do have a real problem with our current
administration. No, that's not Republicanism. That's Trumpism. Yeah. What we have now is Trumpism. It has nothing to do with the Republican Party that we grew up in. Well, there's nothing to do with that.
You know, you have all of the qualifications now to be president. You're an actor. You've been on television.
Yeah.
You have a lot of hair. Well,
I know I do have. I do still have pretty good hair.
Yeah, yeah. It's good hair. So yeah. Have you considered running for office?
No, I haven't. And I think, everyone fantasizes about what would that be like. And I feel like, you know, you feel like you could make a... you could stand up and be counted. But what we see with politics is it's I mean, everything has become politics. There's no room for principle. There's no room for morality. There's no, I mean, there is, but it's not a requirement anymore.
I think it
used to be, there used to be at least a veneer of concern about what someone really truly believed at their core. What did they believe? And it needed to be in a realm that was broadly acceptable to people. And it had to be tied to values that we could appreciate. I think that's completely off the table now. And that's very troublesome. I hope we can get back to it, but I don't know that we can. I really don't know. I don't know that anybody really knows if we can get back to it.
It's hard to go back.
It is hard to go back. And yet in the politics that we're looking at, there seems to be, I compare the politics that we're in right now to the wonderful old movie, The Battle of the Bulge, where the Germans were racing for the fuel. And if they didn't get to the fuel, they knew the war was over. And I feel like right now we're sort of on the Republican side in name. And I'm going to say Republicans today really are the rhinos. They are Republicans in name only. It's not Republican Party as we've known it. They are racing for the constitutional gasoline to flip the country completely. And if they don't get there, I think they all know it's going to be a very, very tough ride back. It's going to be a big bounce that they're going to experience. But if they can get there, and that's a real question, if they can get there, they could permanently change the country in a way that I think most of us will absolutely not recognize.
And how close do you think that is? Do you think that'll happen?
I hope it doesn't happen. I think, look, if you're looking at the, and we didn't want to get into a whole political thing here, Gary, but I am a junkie on this. If you look at the polling, if you look at the polling, what we're seeing is that growing numbers of Americans are seriously beginning to question on both sides of the aisle, and particularly the independents, which are so important, are beginning to seriously question the direction that we're moving. And we really won't know. We really won't know until 2026. I mean, in 2026, Donald Trump's presidency could effectively be over in 2026 if the election goes that way. If it doesn't, I think all bets are, it's going to be scary times, I think, for a great many people. Now, look, I'll say this also. I mean, your audience isn't seeing me. As a relatively blonde, blue-eyed guy, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant guy, my life is not going to be deeply affected by what's at stake here. And I'm almost 70 years old, so I'm not going to be around, you know, for huge numbers of, maybe I'll get another 20 years, maybe, you know, but I don't feel like I'm going to be impacted. What I am concerned about is that the promise of America is being impacted by all of this, and things that have been evolving very organically for years and years, trying to make the American experience a more colorblind, fair. And look, we have issues. We've always had issues. We'll always have issues. But now it's in your face, tearing it down, to roll back the clock to a time. And you talk about, you know, how do you turn it back? But it's different. But it's the same. I think there's an effort to roll back to the clock to this time where white America is clearly the dominant force in America. You see it in Christian nationalism. You see it where that force is present. And if you can control that, if you can take the rights of women to vote independently away, although women haven't seemed to be concerned about things that I never thought women would vote for, and they didn't vote against it. And I never thought I'd see that. That was shocking to me as someone who I grew up in a very matriarchal family with a very high level of respect for women. And I'm stunned that women who demographically can control everything, if they, or certainly exert enormous influence over the direction of the country, and they're not doing it. And it's very surprising to me.
We're talking with Dean Butler. He's an actor.
We've really gotten down in the weeds here, Gary. What's going on? We should change the subject.
I find it fantastic. Thank you so much. I'm
going to be burned at the stake when people actually, with your audience, I may not be.
You'll be fine. I want to ask you a related question. So you came to Hollywood after your movie Forever aired on television, and you were going to really make it, and then you didn't make it, and you went back home, and your father encouraged you to finish school.
Yes.
And so I want to find out, do you think that finishing your education was important after all or not? Okay.
Yes, good. I do. I think finishing the education, I think in the sense that I finished something that I began, and it gave me my association with my alma mater that I could have had whether I graduated or not. I mean, they would have embraced me, but I know I have that degree. It's a bachelor's degree. I did not go for a master's. I have friends who went for master's and PhD. I have PhDs throughout my family. That was never, my father never finished college. He did very well in the world. My mother never went to college and has been a vital presence in certainly in my life and in the life of her family. My father was a wonderful breadwinner. But he said to me, in every application he ever filled out, there was that question about where he went to college. And he could never answer that question. Now, today, I don't know, in the way the world is moving, I don't know that that degree is as vitally important as it was at a certain time in the American experience, where it was this credentializing that you're doing for yourself. And if nothing else, Gary, it's saying, I started this and I finished it. And that says to people that you are capable of plotting a course and getting somewhere. And that has value to a lot of people. But I think that we've determined in the world that there are a lot of ways to prove that value. So I think it's different now. And when you think of, and I was very fortunate with my father who said, I will get you through this. If you'll go back and finish, I'll take care of it. He never took, I had no student loans. There was, dad paid for me to go to a small, expensive liberal arts university, the University of the Pacific in Stockton, which is a wonderful school and has evolved with the times wonderfully. It used to be really a liberal arts university. Now it is a science-based university. It is a medically science-based, legally based university, and it's doing exceptionally well for its graduates. I think my degree, everyone's looking for ROI now. When you send your kid to college and you're going to spend $50,000, $60,000 a year sending your child to college, I think you want to know when they come out, and if you're prepared to absorb that expense, that they are going to be able to get a job that's going to put them on some sort of stable economic footing. So they are really out your door at that point. You have prepared them. They have done the work. and they can step into a career and make a space for themselves and make a contribution and support themselves. I think it would have to be very disheartening for a parent to send their child to a four-year university, spend tens of thousands of dollars a year, and have them home living with you again when they come out of school. It's not that, and it happens all the time, but it can't be a great feeling. And I mean, parents are loving parents. They're going to, you know, they're going to step in to the extent that they can. But I think that's a huge anxiety that people have about higher education. I'm very grateful that I was able to finish it. I am very grateful for the relationships I have because of my alma mater. I feel good about it, and I'm proud of where the university is now in terms of how it is forward facing to the world and the services it's providing to its students. It's very gratifying to see that. So I absolutely believe in that college education experience. I think what's challenging is when we all went off to college, there was this sense that you were learning about yourself as much as you were learning about a subject. And in a humanities-based education opens the door to that kind of exploration that you have. A science-based education isn't, while very valuable out in the world, does not necessarily prepare you to look at yourself and your place in the world in the way that a humanities education does. But I also understand that a humanities education doesn't necessarily pay the bills. It's, you know, it's a very rare people who can step into that and make it work.
I opened a little humanities shop down the street, so I got it made. I want to ask you about, the difference when you're acting on stage and you have a line, you know, you're going to be saying the same lines over and over and over again. And when yes. when you're on television, you're in a television series, you just do it one time and then jettison it. Is that a taxing? How does it affect your acting when you're?
Well, I think actors who are working on I have an illusion that I, or a comparison of experience that I came up with as I was doing the new Gidget, which was a very frothy half hour situation comedy thing, one camera comedy. Doing a television series is like taking a long run on the beach and you never touch the same grain of sand twice. Mm-hmm. And it's very satisfying and it's beautiful and it's fun and it's all that. Working on the stage in a long run play is like playing in a sandbox, and you get very, very deeply immersed in the grains of sand around you, and you rebuild that sandcastle over and over again. And the challenge of that work is to stay interested, to really stay interested so that you are. And I think working when you're doing a long run show, there are escalations of growth. I mean, there's huge growth when you open something that where you are learning about your part. You're learning about everybody's part. You're learning together about what this play is. Huge growth there. And then there is a leveling off period that happens different times for different people where it's sort of, you go a little flat. Perhaps, I mean, maybe the audience wouldn't see that in your performance, but you know that you're really not engaged, perhaps the way you were. And then something happens and it triggers a whole other level of growth. And you are going upward again as you're learning and playing and figuring this out. It's definitely a different discipline. You know, I think the wonderful thing about the theatrical tradition is at 8 o'clock, the curtain's going up and someone's going to be in that part. Every part is going to be occupied by somebody. And if you're going to Broadway or the West End in London, everybody who's on that stage, whether they are the person who is the number one in that part or the number three in the part, is going to be wonderful. They're all going to be wonderful because there is a discipline about doing that work. And there is a life force of the people who choose this. I've never been around, you know, working on Broadway, working, doing Into the Woods for Stephen Sondheim. It was not a big cast. I want to say it was probably 20, you know, which is a good size cast, not a huge cast. It wasn't, you know, there wasn't a lot of choral and everybody was, had a part. But the life force energy when that group of people stood on a stage and sang together, it was magical power. You felt like you were joined with these people, and together there was this huge energy that came off the stage. And when the Broadway community gets together, as it does several times a year each year, you know, they do a Christmas thing and they do the Easter bonnet thing and on Broadway, and all the Broadway casts come together in a theater in a Broadway house. And at some point during that, everybody sings something that everybody knows. And oh my God, you cannot believe the energy, the joy in that space as you hear these people who are massively capable. No one's holding back. Everyone's pouring themselves into this. And it's so much fun. And you really feel like you're part of something extraordinary when you get to experience that. And, you know, when you go out on this, you go out 8 times a week and you deliver this thing. And that's the promise, is you show up. You show up and you commit to delivering the goods, what you've promised. And everybody does, from the person who puts the mic in your hair to the person who delivers your t-shirt and your coat to the dressing room, the guy who does the turntable, the lighting, the audio, everyone in that orchestra. It's ultimate team sports where everyone agrees to play by a certain set of rules. Everyone's part's clear and you know what you're supposed to do. And when you do it, and everyone does it night after night after night, you are getting this extraordinary experience in the theater. And to be part of that is, it's amazing as you're doing it. I think the thing that's so stunning, which is a huge contrast to television, Gary, is that when you do your last performance and you walk out of that theater, it's like you never did it, because yeah, it's over.
There's no reruns. It lives
in the memories of the people who watched it.
There's no streaming.
There's no streaming of that. I mean, you certainly, there are today, people do shoot in PBS during those years. They shot, you know, over a week's time, they would shoot Broadway shows, and they were beautiful and with this proscenium approach to presenting something. And it was like a museum piece. It was, it's not the same as being in the theater and doing it. But when you do a television series and you've taken a long run down the beach and you are, you know, you're involved in dozens and dozens of episodes of something, those experiences live on for generations for people. And Little House has that. We celebrated 50 years last year.
Yeah.
Little House has been watched and watched by multiple generations of people. And that love of that property goes back to 1932, when Laura's first book was published during the Great Depression. And people have embraced this American experience. And while our Little House was very different than what Laura wrote, and yeah, I don't know. Have you ever read Laura's books?
No, because I wasn't.
They are absolutely charming, Gary, and you'd blow through them in about 20 minutes a book. Huh. But they are very charming books. They are touching something primal in the American spirit, told from a little girl's point of view, which is a unique voice in that time, to have a young girl's voice.
Absolutely. Well, all right. Hang on.
Check it out.
I'm going to go read them. I'll be right back. I'm going to go read them.
Okay. Very good.
Wait. You know, but so you just talked about as you leave the theater after the last performance, or when you found out when Michael Landon said, you know, we're not coming back next season.
Yeah.
I was struck in your book, Dean Butler, how even then, you don't know what you're going to do next.
Yeah. No.
Did you think about, oh, I guess I have to go back to the furniture store? I mean,
I wasn't thinking I'd have to go back to the furniture store, but you think that you're going to, well, part of you thinks that you're going to go right on and get something else that's wonderful. And another part of you feels like you may never work again in your life. And, you know, so I was sort of, you know, in a 50-50 world there where, did I have the career that I, you know, that I dreamed of having? No, I didn't have that career. But did I have a career that's had a life that goes on, that will go on well after I'm gone, in terms of the work that gets seen? Absolutely. I have no doubt of that. And that's very affirming of what we did. And I don't feel that way about everything I did, but I certainly feel that way about Little House.
When you see, you know, maybe a Little House episode, or you're flipping the channels and something comes on, you know, the streets of San Francisco, and you're in it, do you think, oh, I don't remember ever doing that? Or do you think, well, oh, I remember the day I did that?
I think it's degrees of that. I certainly can tell you I would not remember the specifics of what I did, but I absolutely would remember doing it. I watching a Little House episode, I can't tell you exactly what I was feeling as we were doing this. I'm watching it like an audience member, some hybrid version of an audience member now. And I'm enjoying it or I'm not enjoying it based on what I'm seeing in front of me. And, you know, for the most part, I do enjoy it, with other things that, you know, that occasionally will pop up, like a Murder, She Wrote that I did, or you know, that it's fun to see yourself with those people. You know, it's, that's very entertaining. I'm doing a podcast tomorrow night with Karen Richman, who I did the new Gidget with. Oh. I love Karen and love the work we did together. We had so much, it was silly, frothy. It was cotton candy. It really was. I mean, there was nothing significant in what we were doing, but we had a lot of fun doing it.
And did you have to do any surfing?
I remember that.
Did you do any surfing at all?
No, I did a lot of process surfing where you're standing on the roof of a car, standing on a surfboard, and someone's spraying water at you. You know,
is that how they do it?
I mean, it's classic process stuff against a blue sky. There were certainly people like Don Stroud who played our big kahuna. Don Stroud could surf. Oh. And when we saw him surfing, I mean, they shot it wide enough, you knew it was him on the board. That was never going to happen with me. I could never stand up on the board. I'm very comfortable in the water. I could body surf. I can do all that. I could never stand up on a surfboard. So it's like, okay.
He was a good actor.
Spray water at me. It's okay.
Don Stroud was a good actor. I enjoyed watching him.
Oh, he was terrific. Boy, there was a complex personality.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
Interesting. I mean, he played a wide variety of roles, and I wonder about that. I mean, you know, he played, I saw him on the FBI. He was a psychopath.
Sure. So he played heavies.
Yeah.
And he could be, in our case, with the big kahuna, he was a warm, fuzzy, wonderful guy. And I think he loved being the big kahuna because it gave him an opportunity to tap into the lighthearted side of his personality. Victor French, who was Mr. Edwards on Little House. I mean, Victor had played heavies his entire career. And it wasn't until he played Mr. Edwards on Little House that he got to laugh as a character. And he loved that. It was a great gift to him. And he was a massively talented actor and director who could do anything. He was remarkable. But yeah, no, Don, I think Don had a great energy. But boy, when Don went dark, it could get really dark.
I can imagine. Well, have you ever been asked to really stretch? What do you think was the hardest role?
No, I don't think so. And I just think, you know, there are some actors. I'm like white paint, and you just put a little, you know, it doesn't take much to change it. I think I probably did more diverse work in Class Yeah. As I was testing what I could become potentially playing lawyers and doing parts of lawyers and politicos and these kinds of guys. But that never really presented itself to me. I think I became known as a romantic character. That's how people saw me. And I think, you know, as I was transitioning out of my 20s into my 30s, when that wasn't going to be as rewarded as much, it just, it was not as, it was not as, the work was just not as plentiful for me, which led me to start looking at being behind the camera, which I absolutely loved. I mean, it's from a mental, emotional, or from a mental perspective, from a participatory, being behind the camera, the producers really are the ones who have all the fun because they are vested from day one till the end, but you're never going to be as famous as the person who's in front of the camera for you doing the thing, because it's, I mean, if that's the goal, if to be known is the goal, you've got to be on camera for the most part. Okay. There's Steven Spielberg, who's, you know, very, because he's one of the great directors of our time. Most of the time in television, directors are not known. They are incredibly important. Michael Landon was a brilliant director and a wonderful presence on camera, and he had both things going. That's very rare that someone has that.
All right, I have to ask you a very important question, Dean Butler. Will you come back to my show again?
Gary, if you'd ask me to come back, I think you are a wonderful conversationalist, and I've enjoyed this enormously. What a treat. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you. So the book is called Prairie Man, My Little House Life and Beyond. The author, the actor, Dean Butler, soon to be the next president of the United States.
Not likely, Gary.
Thank you so much. Really a pleasure talking to you.
No, thank you, Gary.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf. And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.